Blog Talk Radio.
Are you, are you? Hey! Our ears have heard and our eyes have seen, and I know we'll be blessed by you. And a lot of people blessed by you, Jehovah.
Happy New Year, everybody, and welcome to our first broadcast for this year. Of course, my colleague just finished his talk on perspective. He's an incumbent from the great city of Dallas in the state of Texas. We're looking forward to a great year and wonderful things ahead of you. As we celebrate our 7th anniversary at Zambia Blog Talk Radio, and we appreciate everybody's participation and commitment to supporting us. If you wish to, keep us going and see things, make some great progress on what we do, just go to our website, Zambia Blog Talk Radio, and you are going to find a PayPal link there. You can support us and just make contributions. Roger, good morning, and great show, my friend.
Good morning. We started slow with the systems, but time has always been on our side, learning how to go by without losing faith. So we are thankful for a good show anyway.
Excellent. All right. Happy New Year. Everybody, welcome to the show. And we are hosting Michael Chishala. He's an online blogger, ICT specialist based in Lusaka. Michael is going to tell us how an engineer has turned into a blogger and doing all these other things. Michael wrote an article which was posted to Lusaka Times, and it is entitled, this is the reason why I've always been looking for somebody to discuss this constitution issue. So you can, as we are talking, you can go to Lusaka Times and search for Michael's article entitled Zambia, an NGO-driven constitution or people-driven constitution. And Michael is our guest today on our first year special feature. Michael, good evening from Lusaka. Happy New Year and welcome to Zambia Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, good evening to everyone who's listening. Yes, and it's a Happy New Year in Lusaka. In fact, the sun is still up, actually. It hasn't yet set.
Oh, that's interesting. At 6 o'clock, eh? Excellent, yeah. Michael. We are great to have you on the show. Let me get into the thick of things so that I can give an opportunity as well to my... Because I've got a lot of things to discuss with you. But like I mentioned to you on this forum, we have a policy of letting our callers, people listening online, ask their questions on Twitter, on Facebook, so that they can also have an opportunity to ask their questions. Help everybody listening understand why Zambia, an NGO-driven constitution or people-driven constitution. What prompted you to come up with such a title?
Well, I've been following the constitution debate for many, many years, probably 10 mm-hmm. or so. So, you know, it's something that I'm very, very interested in because I've sort of seen the connection to a good constitution and development, especially in terms of the legal framework, things like the powers of the president, and also the political climate has to be good and stable so that it encourages investors to come in. So anyway, I noticed that the public discourse seemed to be dominated by a lot of NGOs, you know, people like the Grand Coalition, FODEP, NGO, CC, and so forth, who were basically arguing that the so-called piecemeal enactment of the Constitution was not right, you know, that the PF had mutilated the Constitution working with the MMD and so forth. So I felt that was extremely unfair of them to say that. So as I, you know, followed the debate more, I thought, yeah, let me just put my thoughts down. And that's how I, you know, basically talked about it from the angle of the influence of NGOs on the constitution-making process and how the fact that they've actually been very influential in the clauses that have ended up in the constitution. But at the end of it, when some of the things they've championed are adopted, you know, they're the same people to come and turn against it and say, no, PF and MND have mutilated the constitution. So that's kind of the general background of how I ended up writing that article.
Excellent. You speak very strongly about interest groups. That's the word you use, okay? Interest groups, NGOs, even political parties have been put into that group, Grand Coalition, FODEP, and all these groups. They seem to be pushing a certain agenda. Discuss with us what that agenda that you address in your article, this agenda is. What is that agenda?
Okay, in my article, I basically argue that a lot of these NGOs are funded by donors, various donors, some of them Western. I don't know how much of the donor money comes locally, but I think from what I've gathered, the bulk of it comes from outside. So, of course, since they are financed as NGOs, they have to demonstrate that they are relevant by producing results. So if they push for certain things, you know, they get more funding and it helps them. And some of the things they push for might require further work down the line. So, like, the example I gave was that something like the referendum. Let's say, you know, it would be shown, you know, this time around was going to be adopted through a referendum. The NGOs are going to get a lot of funding to allow them to go out and do sensitization exercises, for example. And since some of the clauses in the Constitution, they are the ones who pushed for them, so it's also in their interest to go out and start basically marketing that, no, we want you to vote yes, because the way a referendum is, it's not like an election where you pick from a list of candidates. A referendum is just a yes or no question. Just one question, okay, should we adopt a new Constitution, yes or no? So if they've put in the clauses that they've pushed, obviously they'll have now to go and give people reasons why they should vote yes. And they'll tend to focus on those kinds of clauses that, you know, that they submitted during the different constitutional review commissions, the NCC, you know, and then the technical committee, you know, hearings and all that sort of thing. So it's basically, to put it bluntly, in their self-interest to actually do what they are doing because, you know, they're going to gain financially out of it, basically.
You know, I like that point. When I read that point, I just said to myself, I can imagine I started thinking about my colleagues on this forum, Kelvin, Dr. Kalonde, Roger, everybody, Dr. Patrick. I'm like, I wonder how my colleagues are going to respond to that. Here is something else that I pick from your article. And by no means do you claim for this to be factual, to be accurate. You actually use the word unscientific, okay? You give an estimate, sort of statistic about the unscientific estimate of like the Mungomba Commission, for example, only had 1% of the population of Zambia participate in the actual submissions to the commissions and all those things. By the way, I'm one of the 1%. I did make a submission on that. Tell me how this speaks to the noise that is made in the media by the same people we are referring to as the interest groups in comparison to the unscientific statistic that you give about the people that really participated in the constitution process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, as I indicated, the vast majority of people just simply don't care enough about this whole thing. And like I said, I gave what I even called an unscientific estimate of 90% of Zambians, mm-hmm. I think don't really care. And I say this partly, A, because if you look at the people who actually submitted, there were less than 13,000 people who submitted to the Mongomba Constitutional Review Commission. And if you calculate it from the population of Zambia at the time, it's just over 1%. That's firstly. And then secondly, you know, I've had all kinds of discussions with people, middle class, upper class, lower class, people from the shanties and so forth. And, you know, the sense I get is that most of these people just are not really interested. They're more interested in how to make a living, for example. And then the most shocking thing of all is that when this bill, the Constitution Amendment Bill of 2015, went into Parliament, there were a lot of MPs who were debating it, but they hadn't even read the contents of the Constitution itself. And this came out afterwards, where all of a sudden people are complaining that, no, there is requirement of grade 12 certificate for you to stand as a councillor or as an MP. And you think, but these people had time to debate it, read it, why didn't they raise that particular debate in Parliament? Why haven't they been talking about it all this time? It's like now that it's about to be signed into law next week. That's when all of a sudden people realize the ramifications of the clauses in the Constitution. So if even the MPs themselves, some of them don't bother to read, you know, that just shows that the interest in the Constitution is not as much. And, I mean, I've tried to read a lot of different clauses in the Constitution, but even I can confess I've never read the whole thing from cover to cover, but I've just read the things that interested me. And I'm supposed to be one of the more, shall I say, exposed people. So you can imagine what the rest of the Zambians are. They'll argue on specific clauses, yes. You know, like there was that time there was a proposal for the degree clause for a president. There was a huge debate about it, but that was just about it. But the average person, I think, just isn't bothered enough. That's why I gave that unscientific estimate of 90%. I think 90% just don't care. But in the media, there's so much noise. They make it appear like everyone is really interested in this thing.
Anyway, yeah, and we use the expression people-driven constitution. Now, this is what I want us to do, everybody. I want us to just pause a little bit here on this issue. We've got a statistics expert here because we work for statistical CSO, Statistical Office in Lusaka. He's still a statistics expert, Cletus. Most of you may not know that. Cletus, are you there? Yeah. Cletus, Michael is clearly not claiming that his estimate or his assessment is scientific. He's actually using a scientific estimate. Now, as a statistician, what do things like this speak to? And what do they reflect when you are talking about any subject and the level of involvement of the people?
Yeah, yes, Michael, your article is very deep and very mind-provoking, and a lot of things you put them right. And, you know, earlier on this radio, you are talking about something very closer to that. As you have rightly put it, you know, the participation of the population, you know, matters. And you know, the problem is with things like the Constitution, they are very...
Cletus, if you're on speaker, you're not coming on very clear.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sorry. Do I sound better now?
That's good. Yes, I want everybody to hear it very well.
Matters like, you know, the Constitution are very elite, as you rightly put it. And Nathan understands that, you know, even people like myself and even some lawyers, people don't read the whole document page to page, back to back, you know. Everybody will just cherry pick what they think concerns them. Now, as it goes to the public, especially in a poor country like ours, people are so much concerned with something they think is directly related to their livelihood, you know. Mm-hmm. Including making money and, you know, everything else. So today, matters of the Constitution are not as prime, as important as, you know, but the constitutions do matter, you know. And with the population participation, I think, you know, that's a very difficult thing to be able to pinpoint and come up with a percentage. You know, that's why you called it unscientific, because, of course, you didn't do any statistical stratification to come up with, you know, correct measured figure. Because the problem with that is that some people are representatives, so they might be representing a big cloud of population, and they speak for them as their representative in their submission. You know, maybe Nathan, like, for example, Nathan said he did a submission, and we may not count him as an individual. Maybe he did submit on behalf of Gladys and Natasha and everybody else. So we can't count him as one person in submission. So, you know, that those are the statistical tricks that goes with it. But I think you are right that the 90% may not have participated. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Cletus. I just wanted him to come in as a statistician. I mean, Michael, I appreciate you, because there are very few. We've been doing this for a long time, and everybody who reads and follows things, we have Dr. Kalonde here, Dr. Patrick, they can speak from a very strong position. A lot of people listening here, the tendency, I'm commending you for this, Michael, is because we tend to make what is commonly called what, alarming statement, and things like that. Let's go back to your article. Proportional representation. What do we mean when we say proportional representation? What is it?
Okay, from my understanding of the whole thing, the idea basically is to have a set of MPs who are not necessarily directly elected, like the way the current 150, and they're about to add six more, so it'll go to 156. Those are up for grabs, anyone can stand. But they wanted to add another 94 MPs to that, and these will be given proportionately according to how the political parties perform in the election. So if Party A gets, let's say, 50% of the vote, just for argument's sake, then of those 94, they are supposed to get half of those seats. It's basically the same system they have in South Africa, and that's how even this gentleman, this controversial gentleman, Julius Malema, he managed to get 25 seats. Because based on the total votes cast in South Africa, his party got a certain percentage. I can't remember what it was, maybe 3% or something. So when they calculated that percentage of those seats under the so-called proportional representation system, that's how he got his 25 seats. So I think the idea is to is for smaller parties that may not outrightly win any seat to still have representation. So, you know, if a smaller party maybe gets 5% of the vote, maybe presidential, and maybe even on the parliamentary side, if you total up their votes, it comes to approximately 5%. They may not have won any seat outrightly, but they've got 5% of the vote. So 5% times those 94 MPs, and they get whatever the figure is. I don't know if it's 2 or 3 or whatever it is.
Okay. Michael, in reading your article, before I bring in my colleagues, let me ask this issue. You address the issue of referendum, which is big, I believe, and this whole process of the difference between doing things through parliament and where the interest group stands, that's where I think the debate comes in. Referendum to get a success, I'm quoting from your article, referendum to get a successful constitution is not necessarily true. I want you to discuss what are we not being told about how the referendum works and how it will affect this constitution process.
Okay, the thing about the referendum, if you actually read the Referendum Act, it specifies that for any referendum to be valid, first of all, you have to have 50% of the eligible voters to actually participate in that referendum. Not registered voters, but eligible voters. So now, the big question, which I haven't heard discussed, I mean, I've heard people who've argued on the other side to say no, there's nothing that prevents us doing it. But here's now the question. How do we determine how many are the eligible voters in a country?
That was going to be,
and that's the question. And that's the question which a lot of people don't address. What are the mechanics? So you know, for you to know, for someone to be an eligible voter, there have to be a certain minimum age. I think it's 16, if I'm not mistaken, and above. So the question I would ask is, right now, do we know how many people who are 16 years and older there are? And I think it's very difficult to come up with that figure, because the last census we held was in 2010, which was more than 5 years ago. We are kind of in between, and the next census is going to be in 2020, because the census is the only foolproof method of determining A, the population, and B, how many people 16 and above who are there for eligible voters. So, I mean, unless I'm mistaken about this, but my understanding is that therefore to conduct a referendum, ideally we should have a census first, and once you've established your population, find out what the eligible voters are, and then based on that you have a figure to work with. So if, say, for example, you discover that your eligible voters are out of the 14 million Zambians, maybe, I don't know, 7 million or 8 million are eligible, then you know, okay, 8 million people have to, these are the eligible voters. Of these, 50%, i.e. 4 million, should be able to cast their ballots in that referendum for it to be valid. Those sorts of things. And on top of that, there's still the question of sensitization, because an election for, say, an MP, a council, or a president is straightforward. You just have a ballot paper. The parties themselves campaign, tell people vote for a candidate. But in a referendum, it's a bit more complex, because you have to go out through the entire country explaining to people about the referendum. What are they voting for? Because they just can't stick a ballot paper in front of them and say, oh, do you accept the new constitution, yes or no? And they don't even know what you're talking about. So you have to have meetings in all the districts, all the constituencies. You have to start explaining to people. So in my article, if you read it, I expressed great skepticism that the referendum will even be held this year. I mean, 11th August is the election date. You count how many months is that? That's like 7.5 months. So I find it extremely difficult to believe that in 7.5 months, A, they'll depend on how many eligible voters there are, B, they'll finalize the voters' roll, C, they'll do all these sensitization exercises and explain to people what the referendum is about, and then they'll print another set of ballots alongside all the rest. Because just the referendum alone, its cost is probably almost the same as the cost of the other election. So then the budget will be doubled. So I think these are things that have not been explained very well. And sometimes I suspect that NGOs who argue for the referendum haven't been completely forthright in explaining these complications in holding a referendum. I mean, we haven't had a referendum since 1969. So I don't know, maybe we've even forgotten how to do it.
You know? Good. Roger, this whole process is not as transparent as it is being thrown to us. Roger, are you there? Okay. Yeah, then then I don't seem to see any... okay, Kelvin, this process then is not as transparent as we are looking at it on face value.
Yeah, based on Michael's explanation, there's definitely no transparency. And the fact that you have to go around the country to sensitize people just makes the whole process very complicated. But one question I had, and I want Michael to...
Yeah, go ahead if you have any questions. Go ahead.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I want Michael to educate me on this. What would be the purpose of us pushing the agenda of adopting the Constitution through a referendum when the president has assented to it? Isn't it a choice of one or the other? I mean, if the president or Parliament discusses it and adopts it and the president assents, why should we go for a referendum?
Okay, the thing is, maybe that I didn't explain. If you look at the current constitution as it stands, you can amend, the parliament can amend any part of the constitution except one section, and that's the section on the Bill of Rights. For the Bill of Rights to be amended, you have to have a referendum. That's what the law says. So the thing is, when this new constitution is signed into law, it has approximately 80% of the clauses that were in the whole draft constitution, and 20% have been left out. But that's an approximation. I don't know what the exact figure is. So the NGOs, like, and I do mention them, like, say, the JCT, Jesuit Center for Theological Reflection, they've been arguing to include some new rights, which they call the economic, social, and cultural rights, ECSR, whatever. So they include certain rights, like the right to employment, you know, the right to food of acceptable standard, and things like that. Now, those additions to the Bill of Rights cannot happen minus a referendum. So that's why their argument is that this year, alongside the election, let's have the referendum so that now people, the Zambians, will have a choice to vote whether that remaining 20% will be added. Of course, in the original plan, the entire constitution was going to be subjected to referendum. And as I note in my article, the NGOs cannot guarantee that it will go through. You know, maybe we might fail to get the 50% eligible voters, for example, or time might run out. So if we remain under the current constitution, it means we go into that election under the current first-past-the-post system and a lot of other things that probably might give a lot of advantage to the ruling party. So it becomes now a situation where if a new party comes in or the existing one comes in, they might not have appetite to push the constitution, and then it might become dead in the water. Maybe another 5 years later, we're still arguing about it. That's why my view is that it's much better we at least enact part of the constitution and continue enacting the other clauses later on. In fact, in my own view, and, well, it might be a bit controversial, but I don't even think those economic, whatever, social rights are even necessary. In fact, in my article, I refer to them as absurd. I use the very strong word like that, and I think the reasons why I think they're absurd. Like the right to employment, for example. I mean, how can government guarantee that every Zambian will be will be in a job somewhere? That's just impossible. There's no government anywhere on this planet that can guarantee 100% employment. And in fact, if you speak to economists, they even argue that some level of unemployment is actually good. I think it's something like 4 or 5% unemployment is good for a country. And the reason they give is that you need a pool of people who can replace, for example, people who die, people who change jobs, people who leave the country. You know what I mean? I imagine if we had 100% employment and then one guy dies, who's going to replace him? You know, so those are some of the intricacies.
You are listening to Zambia Block Talk Radio, our New Year special feature. We're speaking to Michael Chishala, who has written an article. It's in Lusaka Times, Zambia, an NGO-driven constitution or people-driven constitution. We'll be taking questions from our colleagues that have called in. Michael, of course, like you've already alluded to probably this question that I'm going to ask you. So what are some of the things what are some of the clauses do you think really matter to the people? What are some of the clauses?
Okay, in terms of the clauses, I think, for example, I understand that the new constitution is supposed to strengthen certain offices, like the Auditor General's office, for example. Because one of the things that tends to happen is that there's a lot of corruption, theft, misuse of money that happens in government. The Auditor General writes her report, it goes to Parliament, and then nothing happens. You find people are rarely prosecuted. But if I recall correctly, there was a proposal that the Auditor General's office should be strengthened to the point that it can initiate a process of prosecuting erring civil servants. So these civil servants and other politicians, basically, they will steal money, they will misappropriate money. And the Auditor General will catch them, but they are not being prosecuted. So if the Auditor General's office is strengthened, I think that helps a lot with that. And then, of course, there are these other things like the running mate clause. I think a running mate clause is good because it eliminates the need for a presidential by-election. Although, when I studied the draft bill further, I actually discovered that there is one unique case where it's still possible to have a presidential by-election. And that's the case where, let's say, the president the office of the vice president becomes vacant. According to the new constitution, the sitting president has to nominate someone, and it goes to Parliament and they have to vote 2/3, 106 MPs. Now, if subsequently, okay, so let's say a sitting president, maybe his vice resigns or dies or whatever, he replaces him, and then he himself, the president, for whatever reason something happens to him, he's no longer in office. According to the new constitution, a vice president who was appointed cannot ascend to the office of the president. Instead, what has happened is the Speaker of the National Assembly takes over, performs executive functions for 60 days, and then a fresh election is held. But yeah, but that's, well, then it would mean both the president and the vice would have to be removed from office by whatever process, whether it's death, resignation, incapacitation, or whatever. Of course, it's unlikely, but it's possible. I mean, and we even have a historical precedent that happened in the United States, where in, I think it was 1973, this gentleman, Richard Nixon, was the president, and his vice actually resigned because he was charged, I think, with money laundering and tax evasion. So the vice president, Richard Nixon, his name was Spiro Agnew, he resigned in 1973. So Nixon had to put a vice president. So he put Gerald Ford as his vice president. But then Nixon himself was caught up in the Watergate scandal, and he had to resign in 1974. So Gerald Ford became president, even though he had been picked by Richard Nixon. And then picked another guy, Gerald Ford, rather. When he assumed the presidency, he appointed Nelson Rockefeller as his vice president. And that's how it was solved. In fact, originally there was no provision for succession of vice president. And in fact, even when John Kennedy was assassinated and Lyndon Johnson took over, he actually had no vice president for almost 2 years until 1965, when he actually had the full term. That's when he had. So they did in America what they call the 25th Amendment, where they actually explained explicitly the same process. Now, in our case in Zambia, we've copied most of it, but we've left out that last bit, that if a VP is appointed, then, you know, he can't ascend to the office. So anyway, although I've gone a bit roundabout, but the bottom line is that it will cut costs, basically, on these by-elections. Then there's the issue of also parliamentary by-elections, because in the new constitution, if you cross the floor, you'll be banned from standing as an MP for the life of that parliament. You know, when PF took over, they petitioned something like 50 seats of the MMD. Of those 50, I think we've had something like 30 by-elections. So you do the math, it's like 5 million kwacha per seat. You know, 30 times 5 million, that's 150 million kwacha just wasted. You know, so all that money, you know, 150 million kwacha can do a lot. You can build rural health posts, probably 100 rural health posts or something. There's so much things. So those are some of the progressive causes that I think will help with the governance of the nation, among others. Even the dual citizenship one, I think, is good. You know, makes it easy for Zambians to, like, who've changed their citizenship and renounced Zambian citizenship, to get it back, maybe to be able to get land, to things that invest in them, et cetera.
Okay, excellent. Let's go to the front lines. I'll bring in Dr. Kalonde. Those of us that are joining us, we're discussing the Constitution based on Michael Chala's article, which is on, you can read it on Lusaka Times, Zambia, an NGO-driven constitution or people-driven constitution. Dr. Kalonde, go ahead.
Yes, hi. The gentleman seems to be so eloquent and at least knowledgeable of the way things are happening in Zambia. Unlike some of us who are concentrating in other fields and just yapping about Zambian politics. Now, my question is, what is the mood of the people in terms of having the referendum? And as you said, there will be need for education, which is very cardinal for people to participate adequately. Does it seem like the government is doing something to help the people or the opposition themselves? Are they geared to help the people in Zambia to understand what a referendum is? And if they're doing so, how are they doing it?
Okay. For me, I don't see any real appetite for a referendum, actually. And I don't see any real movement in the political parties to have a referendum, maybe except the UPND, since they've explicitly taken the position of the Grand Coalition and said that they are against the piecemeal enactment of the Constitution. So maybe them. But in my own honest view, I doubt very much that political parties will get behind that process. Part of the reason is every party has got limited resources. So the question is, would they rather spend that money pushing it into their own candidates, you know, presidential, the parliamentary and councillors, or would they rather spend it going around and explaining to people why the constitution should be adopted? I mean, through a referendum, rather, those remaining 20% of the clauses. I don't expect that they'll be interested in spending money on sensitizing people. So what that leaves there for the NGOs to sensitize people and also the government, assuming they will go ahead with the whole referendum thing. So money has to be found to do all those sensitization exercises in all the, I don't know if it's 103 districts or 110, I've even lost count now. And the constituencies, which would be 156 under the new law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. Yeah. We actually need to establish the actual number of districts. It's important. We need to do that. Let me go to my colleague in Canada. Roger, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Nathan. Michael, thank you so much. Like Bakalondia said, you are well, you know, versed with some of these things we are talking about. I want to hear again. I think you talked about something nice, and my ears didn't believe it. Are you saying if a member of parliament crosses to another one, they'll ban them for life, for that life of the city?
Yes, that's correct. It was there, you know, in the MCC, we debated that clause, and pretty much it was agreed, if I'm not mistaken. But I've read through the text, actually,
mm-hmm.
and it's very, very clear that if you defect, you know, because like what happened when President Michael said that the PF came into office, they petitioned all these seats, and then we had the case, for example, of Stephen Masumba, who was an MMD MP in Mufumbo. He had gone under MMD. He defected, he was poached by the PF, they even made him a minister. And then when the by-election was held, he actually stood on PF, and he managed to win the seat. And there are so many other examples, Doris Lea, Michael Katambo in it's one of the Copper Belt seats very recently, last year. So under the new laws, if you defect, then you will be banned until that parliament comes to an end. You never spend anywhere in Zambia on any seat. You have to wait for that parliament to expire. So if you defect halfway, you know, the other 2 years, you can't be an MP.
No, that is very, I think that is very, very progressive. Very progressive. What are other things, that's my last question, actually. What are other things, progressive things, which you think will strengthen the government institutions, or the Zambian institutions in general, which you are seeing in this constitution, Michael?
Yeah, okay, yes. I mentioned the strengthening of the Auditor General's office to prosecute erring civil servants. Hopefully that will reduce theft in government, you know, embezzlement and so forth. Because as I had explained, the Auditor General currently can't effect a prosecution. So there was this proposal that the Auditor General should have at least some leeway to start the process of prosecuting erring civil servants. So that will help save a lot of money. Now, this issue of corruption actually is very, very huge. And mm-hmm. I'll just mention briefly something I read on the internet which actually shocked me. In South Africa, there was some organization that did the research to estimate how much of the South African GDP is lost due to corruption. So at the time they did the research, they found that something like between 20 and 25% of the South African GDP is lost through corruption. And they have much better systems than us. So you can imagine in Zambia, maybe even 30% is lost through corruption. You know, our GDP is, I think before it was rebased, it was in the region of $25 billion. So you can imagine anything between $5 to $7 billion is just lost through theft, corruption, and all those things. So things like strengthening the Auditor General's office helps to reduce that kind of corruption. And I mentioned dual citizenship as well, and how it will affect investment and that sort of thing, and a few other clauses that I thought were very progressive. Even the 50% plus one, I think, is actually good. Because, I mean, we had the case in 2001 where Levy Mwanawasa became president with only 29% of the vote, meaning 71% of Zambians were actually against him. So if you notice, when Manasseh came in office, he had a lot of people against him. Some of them actually were loyalists and so forth, because he didn't have a majority. So he really had to try to impress the Zambian people. But they were 50% plus one, although I know it's more costly because you potentially have two elections, but at least you have a resounding mandate from the people, and it's much more difficult for you to be fought by people.
Excellent. Thank you, Roger. Let me go to Pennsylvania. Uncle Daniel, go ahead.
Thank you.
Your line is not clear.
No. 1 minute. Can you hear me?
Okay, go ahead.
So, and let me wish you a happy new year, and a happy new year to Michael too in Zambia. And just, it's going to be quick. And before I ask my questions, someone was we were sharing something yesterday about 10 influential countries in Africa. And all what they had in common is because they have invested in their citizen. And some countries that made number up on top, you know, I couldn't even believe they can be on top. And the countries that I thought it might be, you know, they might be on top, they are not there. And what made them different is because of they have invested in human resources. And Michael, too, when I'm not clear about the NGOs, with what they have to do with the constitutional or making of the constitution of Zambia. Do you think it's because the reason they're involved in it is because they have seen that the government doesn't invest in the resources? Then another thing about the right to employment, I didn't understand that. Do you think it's the reason someone says that everyone have a right to employment is to encourage the government to create employment and
okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Let me discuss those rights, the so-called economic, social, and cultural rights. Just maybe a little bit again. The thing is, okay, when you make, you see, here's the thing. Actually, I've just realized that there's one thing I did not explain very clearly, which is that these rights that they want to put in the Constitution, which were championed by NGOs like JCTR and others, they actually are going to, they're going to be justiciable. Justiciable is some legal term that just means you can sue if you don't have them. So, you know, if someone, for example, steals your property, you've got the right to property, you can take them to court for stealing your property, right? So in a similar way, things like the right to employment, the right to clean water, and all those kind of things, they want them to be justiciable, meaning you can sue if you don't have them. And in my article, I even gave an example. I said the South African Constitution actually adopted those rights. They have them in their Constitution. So I'll give one example, which I never explained in the article, just due to space. Like, there was one gentleman who had a problem with his kidneys. So he needed to use a kidney dialysis machine, which is a very expensive machine to maintain. And he was getting it free of charge from the South African state. Then at some point, the cost became too much, and they had to withdraw that machine. So the gentleman said, I have the right to health provided by government, uh-huh. free health or whatever it was. And he goes to court, and he sued the South African government. But at the end of the case, he actually lost the case because the judges, the Constitutional Court of South Africa, realized that, you know, if you say, okay, yes, he has the right to this, therefore the government should continue paying, then the whole country is going to sue the government who don't have those free health services or don't have jobs or education and all those things. And then the government will just become bankrupt instantly, because how can they provide free medical services at huge cost to everyone, education to everyone, and employment to everyone? And so after he lost the case, in fact, he even died, actually. And there was even another case involving water, where some water utility companies drew water in some community. It's like they hiked the tariffs, and the community refused to pay. Then they sued, said, no, we should have access to water, but they also lost the case. So all these cases that have been taken into constitutional court are always thrown out. And the courts argue what they call progressive realization, i.e., we can't do this now, but later on it will happen. So in my view, it's just an academic exercise, the whole thing. Because you can't say everyone has the right to employment, and many people are still unemployed, mm-hmm. and the government can't provide employment. Because they can't issue a decree saying we want everyone to be employed, and they can't force private companies. And then if they try to expand the civil service to accommodate those people who don't have jobs, then we end up back to unique days, calendar days, when we have people being paid for doing nothing, you know, just to create employment. And the government like that will just go bankrupt and they start taxing everyone more, you know, and it's just not a situation that can ever work. So that's why I think those things can never work. And to my knowledge, they've never worked in any country on it. So what is supposed to happen is that the government should just create policies that make it easier for business to be done and for people to engage in business activities. So they should remove barriers to business entry. They should make licensing cheap, cost of doing business laws, simplify their laws, make it predictable policy. Then people just engage in economic activities on their own and the economy will grow rapidly to the point where people will now move out of poverty, which is what happened in China. I mean, in China, 300 million people have moved from poverty to become middle-class people, and this happened in just 30 years. Do the math, 300 million people for 10 years. You know, that's amazing. And I think that can happen in Zambia as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent. Let's take one more question before we conclude with Michael here. We're testing the waters with Michael. I'm going to Florida, Sunshine State, Mrs. Lucas. We're testing the waters here with Michael. We'll bring him back to talk about other issues as well to do with the Constitution. And those that are listening and everybody, please remember this is our seventh year. We need your support. Go to our website, zambiablogtalkradio.com. There's a PayPal link there. Any donation goes a long way. Matilda, go ahead.
Thank you, Nathan. Happy New Year. Compliments of the season to everyone. Nathan, thank you so much for bringing Michael on, for reading the article, first of all, and finding him. This is excellent stuff. Great way to start the new year. Michael, you are very thorough. Thank you so much for taking time to explain these things. You know, sometimes, as previous people have said, people just talk without giving us fact or giving us, you know, the actual basis. But my question to you, you mentioned something that stood out, knowing those who have reached the age of 16, and this is between census. Is there a way that a Zambian volunteer group or company or something can be hired to find out, to do a mid-census? Is there such a thing to do, to find out, to get statistics on the demographic of the nation so that, you know, the right people are targeted? And then, okay, I think that's my only question. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. Michael, you want to respond?
Yes. Okay. As far as I know, unless I'm very mistaken, it's only the Central Statistical Office that has the legal mandate to count how many people are in this country through a census. So I'm very doubtful that it's possible to use another private company to do a census. You know, there'll be questions of who will they be accountable to, who's going to pay for them. Is there a risk of the results being rigged? You know, all those kind of questions. Now, maybe a better question, or rather a slightly different question, might be, can we hold the census, you know, before the next one, which is in 2020? I think that's possible, as long as the correct laws, or I don't know if it's statutory instruments, are passed. But of course, usually, the argument would be, what about the cost? You know, because to conduct the census to count approximately 15 million people is not a joke. You know, that's millions and millions of households which they have to, you know, count. And I happen to know a few people who worked at CSO or work there, and they've told me that, you know, they have rules, for example, like if you visit a house and you bounce, you don't get the information. You actually have to go back a further two times. You have to visit three times, you know, to make sure. And then in the end, if you fail, that's when you say we have failed. So you can imagine the time, the effort, the money, and it's not just that, even the training, because those people who do the census have to be trained first. So there's factor, there's money, there are resources, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why I say that I find it very unlikely that a referendum will be held this year. But who knows, you know, maybe I might be surprised.
Michael, you...
in your article, you seem to entrust or imply that Parliament is legitimate or competent to do this process of the Constitution. This is my concern, and I want you to respond to this. My concern is that Parliament can manipulate things through things of caucuses within party circles or party streams, party lines. The example I have for you is when FTJ and his MMD put in the parentage clause in the Constitution to try and bar Dr. Kaunda from standing. Somebody may have that concern. How would you respond to that?
Yes, that's a very, very legitimate concern. I mean, even I myself feel the same way to an extent. You know, the same parentage clause, you find that depending on who's the sitting president, if they think certain clauses don't favor them, they might obviously do some maneuvers to try to remove them or to add them. And in fact, even this last debate in Parliament, I actually listened to some of it live. One of the big issues that was debated was cabinet from outside Parliament, because in the draft constitution, it said that all ministers should be picked from outside Parliament, the same way the American system is. But the MPs shut down that in the debate. Now, if you think about it for a few minutes, you realize that the reason they shut it down is that it means that they as MPs can never be picked as ministers, you see? So they're already getting money as ministers, as MPs. You know, they get a loan to get a $50,000 vehicle, for example. But when they appoint the cabinet minister, it's like another level. They get a lot of allowances and a lot of money. So if cabinet is picked from outside, then they won't, you know, be picked. None of them will ever be picked. So it was not in their interest as MPs that that clause was going to be put in. Meaning, because if they stand in, you know, in August and they win, they won't be picked as ministers. So that's the thing. So in a way, you could argue that that was a, if I could call it a manipulation in inverted commas, of a clause that was left out. So it's a legitimate clause, but the point is, you know, I don't think there's nothing much we can do about it other than making sure that we elect better MPs. And this is why I like the grade 12 certificate requirement, because now, you know, we're hearing some MPs don't, you know, they've just going to get to grade 7 or grade 9 and some councillors. But at least the person with a grade 12 certificate is a bit more exposed, shall I say, to knowledge and the educational system. So with such clauses, maybe we'll have much more progressive MPs who say, look, let's just vote this clause in place because it's good for us. Because currently the problem with picking ministers from Parliament is that, like what happened when Microsoft was president, they ended up having the largest cabinet in, which I think something like 70 total. You know, minister, I think 20 ministers in the main ministries, the provincial ones, as well as the deputies, when you added them up, came to 70 people. Now, Parliament has, what, 158 MPs currently. So 70 of them are basically on the payroll of the president. And for example, he can't be impeached if he does something wrong, because he knows you just make sure, you just threaten them to fire them. To say, if you vote against me, I'll make sure you'll be fired or something, or he might use the intelligence services to harass them. There's all sorts of things. But if at least cabinet is out of Parliament, then the president doesn't have control. So it helps with separation of powers. So, yes, it's a legitimate concern. And but at the moment, we have to work with what we have. You know, which is about to be done, I think, on Tuesday, when the president will sign the bill into law at Hero Stadium, which I like. And then after that, we can come back to Parliament and argue on those other clauses again. Maybe to happen in the next Parliament, I don't know.
Wait. You say you like the idea of the constitution being signed at the stadium?
No, I'm saying that from the media reports, President Lee is going to sign the bill on Tuesday. That's, I think, this coming Tuesday.
Now, Michael, help us here. We had a very heated discussion on that. In the area, in our area segment, as we started about signing at the stadium, what do you sense in the? I know you are in Lusaka, where these things are happening. What are you sensing? What are the people saying? Hey, is it a good idea, bad idea?
Okay, I understand the symbolism and the idea that the president wants Zambians to come, as many Zambians, to watch him signing. But from a cost point of view, I don't think I like the idea. because obviously for the president to be there, there has to be a whole huge entourage, bodyguards have to be taken there, security people have to scope out the area. There's a lot of huge cost associated with it, maybe snacks, I don't know, drinks, who knows. So it would be a huge cost. And I think, considering where we are as a country, financially, I don't think a cost like that can be justified. So what I would have preferred is that you can send the State House, but let it be broadcast live on all the TV stations in Zambia and all the radio stations. That, to me, I think is probably a cheaper way of doing it.
Do we have an idea what... Do we have an idea, Michael, what the cost is? Has the cost been made public, or you are talking about the cost? Do you have an idea what the cost will be? Do you have...
Okay, to be honest, I don't know, but if you were to ask me to make a guesstimate, I would put it in a few hundreds of thousands of kwacha. As I said, there's a lot of cost in terms of preparation, especially from the security angle, and, you know, a lot of other things, and, you know, refreshments and so forth. And also, if I really wanted to be cynical and speak as a pure cynic, I would say that maybe somebody somewhere will get a contract to do something at that ceremony, maybe to provide drinks or food or something, and it's another way for maybe some cadres in PF to make money off that. So I think it's unnecessary in my view. Even though, like I said, I understand the symbolism and the gesture, but I think it's wrong timing. If this had been done maybe 4 years ago when the economy was in a much better shape, I wouldn't complain too much.
All right, everybody. The reason I asked Michael that about him to clarify on the cost, I just wanted us to not to sound like we are leaning on one side. Everything Michael has shared is his opinion. Michael, thank you for spending the time with us. I will be getting back with you, and we need to pick up on some other things.
Yes, actually, there are a lot of other things we didn't discuss, like especially the issue to do with General Nyanda. He had written some letter, and I'd wanted to address his points as well, but I'm sure that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah, we can pick it up another time, and there's a lot of things. You know, the constitution thing is an ongoing thing. What we can do is, after it is signed, then we can schedule another day for us to talk about other things.
Okay, no problem.
Have a wonderful weekend, my friend.
All right, thank you very much for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Everybody, that was our show for today. Michael Chishala, a Zambian blogger based in Lusaka. One or two announcements. Please, in Dallas, we have a funeral. I just want everybody to know that those of us that live in Dallas, whatever we can do, let's go out there and be part of that. We have a family who were also affected by the tornadoes that happened here, and we have posted something there for us to help them in whichever. They've lost their house, and everything was destroyed. All right, this is our seventh year, and if we want to take this to greater heights, if you want to help us financially to push this thing to another level, go to our website, Zambia Blog Talk Radio. There's a PayPal account there. You can contribute any amount. Next week, I'll either HH or Dr. Mumba. HH people, Roger, they called me late last night, and he said probably next weekend will work so that we can come and talk about a lot of things. Thank you, everybody, for calling. Patrick, Happy New Year. It's good to have you on after a long time. And we look forward to having everybody again. Thanks for joining us, and we're looking forward to a great seventh year.
Kuipirendi kuchitoko na mumufolo hama mainei iziwanda zota nizi taeza talema na yuma pempelo atikapenda siku lina azati kumbukila oye chifukwa lelo bantu bonse basobesa ulemu atate imwe Kale osangalala Tuba ingatoki Talema na pepo Kapena mbale wanga Azazi wakuti akula Azazi otawa mavuto Alimumanja mwake Kapena azazi wakuti afuniko limba Chifukwa ni mwamuna Afuniko vuti kila banja Kuti ni bambo wa nyumba Hello atataye wana Siunga ziwe Aza kutunga kutogoro Oh oh